My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagerts, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about Soohan Mamdani, the newly elected mayor of New York City in the United States. But before we really talk about him and why we're talking about him, Walter, you're feeling a little bit under the weather, unfortunately, which is why this episode will be a little bit shorter, but I hope you're fine for the next 30, 35 minutes.
Yeah, just thank you, Dario. Just a cold. So my apologies for my voice. And if I say something really silly, please put it down to the virus, not to my intellect.
All right, but Walter, why are we talking about Mamdani? Because you sent me that message yesterday, and at first I wasn't super sure whether we should record on him, but it's growing on me because I already see different stakeholders in the United States taking the wrong conclusions from this.
And it is, of course, a very interesting symptom of where we are in the West, right? With the center being pulled apart by relative extremes. Now, I certainly don't think that the rise of Donald Trump is similar to the rise of someone like Mamdani or others, but there is, it's very clear that you've got the extremes of the political spectrum essentially running away with it, and the democratic establishment in the middle being left behind. And that's really interesting to analyze. On top of that, my marketing savvy mind also realizes that every time we talk about something that's in the news, like Mamdani or something, then somehow listeners really seem to enjoy that. I would also love to have more podcast episodes about niche topics, but the numbers show that people are more attracted to those big items, right?
Absolutely. And I think it does make sense to spend a few minutes on why this is such an upset and why this is in the news. Because, I mean, ultimately, this is just a mayor of a city of 8 million people. I mean, that's a big city, don't get me wrong. But Claudia Sheinbaum, right, the current president of Mexico, before that was a mayor of Mexico City, and that's a city of 20 million people. So theoretically, a lot more relevant. However, if we look, I mean, New York City is also just very symbolic for the United States, but also for the West in general. And I think we could add that, right? He is, I mean, as you can kind of tell by the name, he isn't your typical white person, who would usually become the mayor of New York City. But he is, well, so he's a US American, but he was born in Rwanda. No. He was born in Uganda, sorry. He was born in Uganda, to Indian parents, and then moved to South Africa, and then moved to the United States only at the age of 7. So that, I think, is kind of what is part of why people kind of care about him. And then the other thing is, of course, his policies, which for a US audience, are radically left almost, and maybe for a European audience are right down center left.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a big difference when we talk about the radical or the extreme in European terms or in American terms. And even though someone like Donald Trump would be the extreme in both places because of the radical departure of basic foundations of liberal democracy, right? Trump is basically changing the identity of the governance system within the United States. That would be very radical here in Europe as well. And you've got a number of populist politicians who are trying to repeat what Trump is doing in the United States. But someone like Mamdani is not actually undermining the liberal foundations. He is making it slightly more social democratic. And for the United States, that's an extreme thing. Bernie Sanders was relatively extreme. Mamdani is relatively extreme. But your average European looks at that and says, yeah, that sounds about right. Left of center, not really much particularly to worry about, right? Because he's not actually promoting any revolutionary agenda in terms of overthrowing the way that the United States is supposed to work.
Based on the first aspect that I covered, right, of where he's from, he's a Muslim. He has a, right, a differently sounding name to kind of what's the norm, at least in the United States. The fact that we're talking about this in 2025 is interesting to me because I don't think we would have talked about this in 2021 necessarily, right? Where it's almost like identity politics, which you, I mean, originally came from the left is now a thing for the right, because the right in the United States made it a big topic of who he is, right? That he is, I mean, that we've seen a lot of racism, a lot of Islamophobia throughout that campaign. And it's of course sad to see, and it's very interesting, I think, and very telling of our times, of how far kind of Trump and the Republicans and just in general zeitgeist in the mood of a country has shifted to the right? That type of stuff is acceptable now. That it is completely, I mean, because we had that with Obama in 2008, where people were like, oh, Barack Hussein Obama, he must be a Muslim. Right, and then very quickly, right, there's that famous video of John McCain, who was running against Obama at the time, kind of saying, no, he's a decent US citizen, please stop that. And then I think I felt like, particularly after Obama, we were kind of past that, right? Yes, it was still celebrated that, oh, maybe there's a Latino representative is here now in government, and then maybe a black representative is here in government, and these are historic things, right? And Nancy Pelosi became the first female Speaker of the House. But it seems like we have kind of gone back on all of that to it being okay to call basically a politician on the opposition a radical Islamist.
This shows exactly the fragility of well-functioning liberal democracy, right? Liberal democracy is not a sturdy tree, as George W. Bush called it. It's not something that will remain in place. Look, the good things about liberal democracy is that it is supposed to be self-improving. It learns from its mistakes. The United States, through a civil war, through centuries of institutional racism, had the civil rights movement and then improved itself and got better. Not perfected. The United States was n never has gotten rid of racism, has never gotten rid of sexism, but there is no doubt that there was more institutional racism in 1900s than in the year 2000s. That is completely objectively obvious. That is the good, that is why people should actually appreciate liberal democracy. But liberal democracy can very easily be destroyed. And that's what you're seeing in the United States now. It requires people to have this foundational sense of decency that goes beyond politics. This foundational sense of we are all in this together, let's become better human beings and let's make society better. And that is completely out of the window. People are angry, people are upset. You don't vote for Donald Trump because you actually are inspired by his kindness or his vision for the future. You vote for Trump because you actually believe that you are the victim of an evil establishment. And therefore, you're no longer interested in being decent. You're no longer interested in being better. You're no longer interested in trying to become less racist, less sexist. And that is what we're seeing now. So, this movement that is very apparent over the past 20 years, is very directly related to the collapse of the foundations of that liberal democracy. In the past, I've equated it to a crash helmet, right? That if you're on a bike and you have a helmet on your bike and you fall down the floor and you crash your head against the floor, then even if the helmet afterwards seems okay, there are all kinds of what are they called? Fractions. Those,
Micro cracks. I don't know.
yeah,
You
yeah,
have
micro cracks.
micro fractions.
Exactly. That you can't see, micro fractions, and you can't see them. So you should replace your helmet. Now, we should have, in the first decade of the 21st century, witnessed those micro fractions. We should have seen something is not quite right here, and we should have thrown out the helmet and said, let's start again. Let's make sure that we keep liberal democracy protected. Let's reinforce the institutions after the damage of the war on terror. But we never did that. The United States didn't do that. Europe didn't really do that either. And those micro fractions now have completely basically taken away the protection of liberal democracy. And that's what you're seeing now in the coverage of Mamdani.
One of those crashes that we had with our bike and liberal democracy was the 2008 financial crisis, which wasn't handled well by Western democracies at all, right? I mean, yes, the banks were bailed out, and overall the economy was fine, but people have not been doing well since then, right? And that was one of the kind of foundations for Trump's rise, to power, because right, not only was it a 2008 crash, but was also right, just the effects of globalization in general. And it's those or, like original social democratic voters, right, that you would at least think, right, that they are supposed to vote, so, like for social democratic parties, because those are the ones who would cushion them from effects like this. That didn't happen. They weren't really picked up by the left, and so they moved over to Trump and said, "Well, I mean, this guy seems to understand us, and this guy seems to care for us." Interestingly, now, right, if we take the horseshoe theorem. Right, which neither of us are entirely subscribers to, I think I should add here, but it is useful to at least visualize right kind of the left and right sometimes. So if we take that and it states that at some point the left and the right, the far left and the far right, they will kind of meet, right, like with a horseshoe. It does seem like this is happening with Mamdani a little bit, because he was actually able to convince and attract some of the Trump voters. Because let's be honest, hey, if you don't have enough to eat, and maybe you've lost your job, or it's just not going that well because of, inflation is eating up your savings, then voting for the guy who's saying, "Don't worry, I'll take care of you, I'll increase minimum wage and I'll keep the rent down," and so on, that suddenly seems to be very attractive for you. And apparently, it's working on some of the Trump voters who are just facing these problems.
Yes, I think that the horseshoe theorem works much better for the large masses, the voters, than for the actual identity of the extremes, right? There's no way, by the way, Mamdani is not a communist, before we get into that, but if you take a communist philosophers and you take like fascist philosophers, if they really exist, because fascism and philosophy don't really go very well together. But you take those, they will not meet in the middle again. They will never meet. They are so far apart. And then you've got some idiot on Fox News pointing out that fascism, Nazi National Socialism, oh, it has socialism in the name. No, it's communist and fascist are philosophically completely different in their approach and in their way of viewing the world. However, the masses are attracted to a similar message, to a similar thing, namely the middle, the establishment is not working for you, and we have a radical solution to solve your problems because the middle is not going to do it. And so that is where the horseshoe actually does work, where you've got a lot of, for example, take your average white factory worker in the United States, that it has no specific sympathy for an extreme right wing or an extreme left wing agenda, but they want to feel heard. They want to feel that someone is out there protecting them against the billionaires and the establishment that seems to keep them down. And whether it's the right or the left that conveys that message, they're okay with that. And so essentially, this is why you see a lot of sort of overflow from one to the other, because it's not about deep philosophical differences that these voters go through. These voters don't vote because they really understand the difference between right-wing policies and left-wing policies. They vote because they want to feel recognized.
What also doesn't help is if, right, the original left representing the workers is suddenly telling the workers that there's all of these things are wrong with them, right? Which was kind of one of those things that we've seen over the last 10, 15 years, where suddenly the Democratic Party, or in large parts of Europe, right, also other left-leaning parties, would turn on their own constituency in that sense, right, and calling these, because let's be honest, a 55-year-old steel worker is not going to use gender-neutral language, and might be very set in his ways and not very accepting of others. But if you're no longer solving the problems that he's actually facing, and then you're calling him a racist, why would that guy vote for you? And it seems like it took the left, at least in the United States, it took them a while to figure that out.
No, absolutely. There are a lot of things coming together here, and even though the right loves to talk and complain about woke culture, and I never really understand what woke means and those kind of, but likes to rant about that, it is completely clear that this kind of moral indignation that often comes from the more left-wing left-leaning sides of society, this righteous anger towards someone because of who they are, can have really, really destructive effects, and that's and drive the masses towards the Donald Trumps of this world, right? Newsflash: until 1950, and arguably until right now, 2025, but let's say be until 1950, essentially everyone in the United States was deeply racist. Everyone in Europe probably was deeply racist. Does that mean that everyone in the United States or Europe were horrible human beings? No, but they had a problem, a racist problem. Now, the moment you label someone racist, the conversation ends. You are a racist. I have nothing to say to you. You're a monster in today's world. Whereas really the conversation should be, like I alluded to before with liberal democracy, how can we become better? Hey, you're a really nice guy. You work hard in the factory. You're a loving family member, family man. All good. However, it's probably also be good to be aware of racist tendencies in you. Let's have a conversation about it. And if you don't want to have the conversation, fine. Society will hopefully move on and you will go along with that, right? That should be the approach. Instead, the anger that exists today, the moment someone shows any type of sexism or any type of racism, is just completely counterproductive, because it makes people who are already struggling in a society that's not working for them feel that they're being looked down upon, that they're not being understood, because your average, you know, loving parent who's also a racist doesn't understand that they are racist. They need to be, you know, in the moment you call them that, then that's it. It's the end. So essentially, there's this societal movement that is breaking down that basic foundational need that liberal democracy has when it comes to when it comes to these issues. We should want to improve ourselves, become better, instead of fighting each other the whole time.
When we now look at that election night from last Tuesday as a whole, right? It was not only Mamdani who won the electoral, the mayor, the election for the position of the mayor in New York City, but there were also two races for governor, right? So there was the New Jersey race and the Virginia race, where in the end two Democratic candidates won, right? So it was in New Jersey, it was Mickey Sherrill, and in Virginia, it was Abigail Spanberger. What is interesting to me is you have these three candidates who won, right? And this, and because it's the United States, any type of election kind of has a big meaning, because that's also right how our media landscape. But this was also the first kind of more important election since Trump took office, so for the last 10 months. And given that the Democrats won all three of them, it was kind of interpreted as a bigger mood swing and a bigger picture, which I would say is not wrong, right? It's not like Donald Trump has been doing particularly well in the United States. Something I learned this morning, what I thought was particularly interesting, is right, Washington D.C. is right next to Virginia. So in the north of Virginia, you have a lot of people who are actually working for the federal government, and they've been out of a job basically. Some of them because of the shutdown, some of them because they were fired in the last 10 months. So it kind of makes sense, right, that people in that area wouldn't be very happy with Trump. Right. All of that to say that you now have three candidates who won, and it might make sense for the Democratic Party to look at that and take some lessons from this and see, okay, maybe can we do something with this for maybe the midterms that are coming up in exactly 1 year. Balder, now what lessons would we take from that, right? Would we go with Mamdani, or would we go with the other two?
It's fascinating, this, right? Before I answer your question, the underlying dynamic here is that your average media reporter, journalist, and your average sort of establishment thinking politician cannot wrap their head around someone like Mamdani. They couldn't wrap their head around Trump either, by the way. And again, I don't really want to equate Trump and Mamdani. I think they're very different. It's not like two sides of the same coin. It really isn't. Like I said, Mamdani functions within liberal democracy. Trump functions outside of it. But they can't relate to the reality of voters who go after Mamdani. And so automatically, they look at two successful women who become governor and say, "Hey, this is the way to go." Whereas, of course, in reality, it would be almost embarrassing not to win right now in the current climate, right? Because it's very clear that Trump is not popular. His approval ratings are the lowest they've ever been, as far as I am aware. At least they're down there. The Republican Party is even less popular.
Right, they're even lower than after January 6th, and
Right.
that's when he tried to kind of stay in power
Yeah.
unconstitutionally.
Exactly. And that is Trump. And then your average Republican is even worse, because at least people somehow feel that Trump is still a bit different from the establishment they hate so much. But a Republican has the worst of both worlds. Republican represents the ugly establishment that people hate and represents the horrible policies of Donald Trump. So if a Democrat cannot win right now, that basically is not a good sign. Obviously, to go back to your question, the answer is that it should be Mamdani's playbook that gets studied by the Democratic Party, not your sort of middle of the road governor. But basically, why is Mamdani driving so many young people to be so enthusiastic? Why is there so many small donations going to his campaign? Why do people talk about him all the time? Exactly what you want if you need to counter that kind of extreme right rhetoric coming from the Trump side. And yet Democrats can't, their brain can't cope with that thinking. They can't cope with the idea that someone like Mamdani might actually have something useful for society, because instinctively he is seen as a communist, he is seen as a revolutionary, radical, extremist, dangerous, etc. Whereas, of course, in reality, he's just someone who tries to provide answers that the Democrats are not providing.
And so it's not only us saying that. And I want to preface what I'm saying with that the Reuters, right, the news outlet, is obviously not a democratic, right, part of the Democratic Party, but it is very interesting because I'm now going to quote from an article that is from Reuters and was titled "Takeaways from U.S. Election Night 2025." Right, was written by James Oliphant, and there it said exactly that. Right, and I quote. So this is, well, I mean, I'm not going to quote directly, but that the two governors winning is kind of a blueprint for how Democrats can win the midterms next year. And it's so obvious, right? That well, I mean, I don't know. The Western bubble aspect here is so obvious, right? Oh, we're comfortable with the establishment, right? Mamdani winning in New York, yeah, that's kind of New York. That's an upset, but also, let's be honest, maybe he only won because there were two other candidates, right? Because the former mayor of New York, Cuomo, who ran as an independent, and then there was a Republican candidate, so maybe that's the reason why Mamdani won. Right, like, uncomfortable with kind of how radical that solution is. Again, radical in big quotation marks here. Let's go closer to the center, aka let's cater more to the others. And when I say let's go closer to the center, it really means, oh, let's go further to the right, because the current political center of the United States has moved a very, very far to the right in the past few years. But that is not the answer, right? That is something that we have seen in 2016 already, when you had Hillary Clinton run against Donald Trump instead of Bernie Sanders. Because, Boulder, you still have a personal bone to pick with the Democratic Party about 2016 and Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, now, I mean, I've said this before, but it was completely clear that someone like Bernie Sanders, who, by the way, is now seen as relatively moderate compared to Mamdani, whereas their message is very similar. It's just that Bernie Sanders has been a reliable factor in U.S. politics for 40, almost 50 years now, and therefore, seems to be more moderate than this young and up-and-coming star from New York. It was completely obvious in 2016, or technically 2015, that the Democrats chose absolutely the wrong candidate to face Donald Trump. Why? Because there was this increasing anger that we've just discussed against the establishment. Who'd you choose? The most establishment candidate of them all, right? Obama was more radical. The word radical doesn't really work for Obama either, but was had at least more of a vision than Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton had been around since the 1990s, since being the first lady, had been senator, had very middle of the road standard approaches to politics, really thinking that we were still living in the 20th century, and therefore completely ill-equipped against Donald Trump. That had, by the way, nothing to do with her being a woman. A lot of people blamed her loss on sexism. I think there's actually very, you know, of course there's sexism in society and in politics, but that would be emphasizing the wrong thing. The big elephant in the room wasn't her gender. It was her politics, her establishment credentials. And Bernie Sanders actually provided a different, fresh voice that also appealed to a lot of Donald Trump voters. Not because they were philosophically the same, but because just like Trump, Bernie Sanders argued that the establishment, both in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, was no longer up to scratch, was no longer capable of providing the answers that the American people were looking for, especially those working classes and lower middle classes that were being left out. And so they went to Donald Trump, whereas they could have gone to Bernie Sanders in a different era.
Now that you're mentioning the Democratic establishment putting up Hillary Clinton is kind of the most establishment candidate you can think of. I mean, that also happened with the person I just mentioned before, that is Andrew Cuomo, right? Who, has been in power for quite a while, had his own little sexism scandal, is also semi, right? I mean, there was this whole thing going on between him and Donald Trump, right? Where Trump put on a lot of pressure on him and he basically caved, which is also why Trump endorsed him in the end. But still, the Democrats thought it was a good idea. You know what? Let's put up this guy in the primaries as our main candidate, because he is really the person that the people want. The people want straight down the middle, your typical manager type of guy, you know, whom they know because he has a face that has been on TV forever.
Yeah, before, absolutely. But before I respond to that, just last week got cancelled. It wasn't a little sex scandal, right? I mean, it was very serious accusations against Cuomo, proven a number of them in court, or at least during the legal process. And, you know, Cuomo was basically a sexual predator. I mean, is a sexual predator. There's nothing to belittle there. But that makes it even worse what you're saying, right? A very dodgy character, a character that should be nowhere near power. Someone who essentially abuses his power, in this case, for sexual abuse. Now, the fact that the Democrats thought that this was a better candidate than Mamdani says everything you need to know about the party. And when I say the Democrats, of course, not the voters in New York, right? In the primaries, Mamdani won. Obviously, that's why he's here now, having won the actual election as well. But it's very clear that the Democratic establishment wanted Cuomo to win. And even though Cuomo was beset by all those problems, political problems, and a completely ineffective legacy as mayor, he still got enormous monetary endorsements from business, from Democratic donors, etc. So he wasn't an easy candidate to defeat in the primaries for Mamdani, nor in the actual election, because big money was behind him. And a lot of Democratic leaders, after the primaries, refused to endorse Mamdani. They said, well, no, actually, I know that he's won the primary election, but I don't really want to take sides here. Whereas in any other situation, they would have immediately said, he is our candidate, we're going to make sure he wins. But no, not Mamdani. We kind of rather would like Cuomo because we feel comfortable with him. And that says everything you need to know about how deep the Democrats' party has sunk, how deep the establishment is in its own rabbit hole and doesn't understand the reality. And it explains everything you need to know about why they can't take the right lessons from Bernie Sanders in 2016 or from Mamdani in 2025. They don't seem to be capable mentally to connect to the world that's out there, because for too many decades, arguably centuries, they've been called up in their own little bubble of politics where there's one way to do things, the middle ground, the middle way, and that's it.
I do have to quickly correct myself from before, right? So not only with what you said about the sexism, no, the sexual harassment scandal. I also made the most European mistake about the United States I think someone can make. I called him mayor of New York City. No, he was governor of New York, right? So sometimes, right, it's difficult to keep those two apart when you live across the pond. So he had to resign from his position as governor of New York following these sexual harassment allegations, which were then investigated and found true, and then tried to make his political comeback, right, to become the mayor of New York City, which of course failed, right? I mean, and you could already see it in the primaries, how much people disliked him doing that. And then I think it's hilarious how uncomfortable the Democratic establishment was with Mondani throughout the right, so throughout the election period or the campaigning period in the last few months.
Yeah, no, it was blatant everywhere. It's obvious everywhere, and there are these interviews that anyone can find from the last couple of months, where journalists actually ask, "Are you endorsing Mamdani, like Democratic leadership?" And they just refuse to. They just say, "Well, no, it's not my state, it's not my city, it's not really my business," and. That must be, if you want to psychoanalyze that, well, there's one kind of almost very ugly aspect to it, which is namely they won't be allowed to say that because of their donors, right? They've got a lot of money that supports Cuomo, that doesn't support Mamdani, and that just doesn't want, and that has links with other Democratic leadership, and that simply doesn't want their candidate to be criticized, and that shows the danger of putting so much money into politics, right? Politicians aren't always or don't always feel free to say whatever they like, which is, by the way, another reason why you should be so happy with campaigns such as the one by Sanders and Mamdani, who depend on small money donations, because they are not as beholden, still a little bit, but not as beholden by financial interest as others. But on top of that, so on top of those very specific practical interests that block Democrats from supporting Mamdani, there's also just the pure psychology that, oh no, Mamdani is a socialist. Oh no, he's a radical, he's an extremist. Also, I have some kind of underlying biases and racism and Islamophobia against him, and therefore my brain just cannot deal with Mamdani as a serious candidate, and I don't want the Democratic Party to become like that. And it's deeply saddening. It's very, very sad, because proper liberal democracy has a strong center that gets made that is held honest by the extremes, right? Any liberal democratic framework has on the right and on the left radicals who keep the system honest, who say, "Hey, keep on paying attention to the powers of the state," or on the other side, keep on paying attention to poverty, to the environment. There are things that you should not ignore, and we will be shouting towards the center so that you keep on doing your job. But that center ground of politics needs to be the driving force behind a decent liberal democratic society, and it's just not fit for purpose anymore. That's the center is gone, and it's not Donald Trump or Mamdani who are to blame. It is that Democratic Party and sort of the old-fashioned Republican Party that simply are stuck in a past that no longer exists.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. We will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That's it from my side, Balder. Which closing quote do you pick for us today?
This is actually a quote, I would think appropriately, from Mamdani's father, Mahmoud Mamdani, who has, of course, been a lecturer and a well-known author, specifically on Western imperialism and post-colonialism. And here he has a nice summary of another person I've quoted very often, Edward Said, who, of course, wrote Orientalism and was an important thinker way before it was easy to criticize the West in that way. So we owe him still a lot, Edward Said, I'm talking about. And I was very happy to find this quote from Mamdani's father, Mahmoud, talking about it. And the quote goes, "Edward Said summed up the principal dogmas of Orientalism in his magisterial study of the same name. The first dogma is that the same Orientalist histories that portray the West as rational, developed, humane, and superior caricature the Orient as aberrant, undeveloped, and inferior. Another dogma is that the Orient lives according to a set of rules inscribed in sacred texts, not in response to the changing demands of life. The third dogma describes that the Orient is eternal, uniform, and incapable of defining itself. Therefore, it is assumed that the highly generalized and systematic vocabulary for describing the Orient from a Western standpoint is inevitable and scientifically objective. And the final dogma is that the Orient is at the bottom, something either to be feared, the Yellow Peril, the Mongol Horde, the Brown Dominions, or to be controlled by pacification, research and development, outright occupation whenever possible.